This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. I well remember the awfully simple request that began the whole business. Darling, could you have a look at the dining room door? It's sticking. But until then, I'd never been asked to display any home-building skills, but this sounded like an easy way to show some proficiency. I mean, quite clearly the door was sticking because it was too close to the floor. So the solution was obvious. File away a millimetre or so from the underside of the door, and hey presto, all would be well. But the door itself did not seem privy to my logic. Because no matter how much wood I filed away, it still stuck. Badly hung, badly hung, said a neighbour who found me sitting among a pyramid of wood chippings. You need to take off the door and realign the hinges. And from then on, it was downhill. The screws wouldn't come out of the hinges unless the door was held up, and so I had to raise it with one hand while holding the screwdriver in the other hand, and then I found I couldn't manage the weight, and I had to let the door fall into the hallway where it shattered a whole section of the newly installed teak effect flooring. Is that you finished? She shouted from the kitchen. Well, it was an experience that prompted just one emotion as I read a new research paper about people who decide to deal with the current housing crisis by building their own house. The emotion, sheer unqualified admiration. I mean, a whole house, for God's sake. Well, that ESRC paper is called The Social in Self-Build, and its author is Nicola Benson, who is Senior Lecturer in Sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and Nicola now joins me. You point out that it's relatively unusual, I didn't know this, in this country to build our own house. About 8%, I think you say, of houses built every year in the UK are self-built, pretty low by international standards. What are the reasons for this low percentage?
Yeah, I think that there are a whole range of different reasons why we have such a low turnout of new houses built through self-build every year. It's stable at around 10,000 to 12,000 houses a year that we build this way, which is actually quite a significant proportion of all new housing provision. It's about 8 to 10% of new housing provision in this country. The reasons, I think, can broadly be summarised as how the housing economy is structured in this country. Things like what access to land is like. It's incredibly difficult to find land, for example. Access to finance for building new properties and planning. Although in recent years there have been some shifts towards making the planning process a little bit more friendly towards people who might like to build their own houses.
I mean, given the housing crisis that we hear about so regularly, I mean, there's no sort of government initiatives, no sort of impetus to get people to build their own homes?
Well, there has been a little bit. So since I started the project in 2012, quite fortuitously, when I started the project, there had been this change in the National Planning Policy Framework, which meant that local councils had a responsibility to measure demand for people to build their own houses. And on top of that, they also announced a rolling fund, the Custom Investment Fund, that was specifically designed to help community groups to actually build
new homes.
Is that
making a difference? It doesn't seem to be making much of a difference.
It's a little bit early to tell, because actually that was just shut down in 2015. The funds had to have been put out. So in the grand scheme of things, we're probably only now starting to see the consequences of what that was.
Now,
like.
You spoke to, altogether, I mean, to 16 households, we can call them, who are engaged in building their own house. Tell me something about these people, what sort of people they are, because I mean, they're not quite the sort of people we've become familiar with through, say, television's grand designs, are we? They don't seem like those people to me.
Well, I think that what's very, very interesting, and I think that Jenny Pickerell's pointed this out recently in the work that she's been doing on ecological building, is that we do have some diversity within that population that doesn't necessarily come across when we look at things like grand designs. And part of that is to do with the different routes that people find themselves entering into building their own home. So you have everything in my research from people whose houses were starting to fall down, you know, for various reasons, and they've become kind of health hazards almost. And it was turning out to look as though it would be not significantly more expensive for them to actually rip the house down and build something completely new than to try and retrofit it in some respect. We also have cases with some of the group projects that I've been following, where we have council-led schemes. There are still council-led schemes and housing association-led schemes, which are ways of getting people housing, which they might otherwise have to wait 10, 15 years to get something that's fit for their family. And those are really very inspirational. And we're starting to see, again, a renewed interest, especially from some London councils, in actually doing that.
I mean, when you're talking to these people, it was interesting to see that, I mean, one of the major obstacles did seem to be, well, obviously it's cost, it's quite clearly a thing, but it was really the unreliability of quotes, wasn't it? I mean, the failing that suddenly, you know, you thought you knew how much the architect was going to cost, the plumber, the construction material. This was a common thing to go wrong.
I mean, I think that that's one thing that regularly gets highlighted. But I think that in addition to that, when we're thinking about financing, what was really, really notable was not necessarily the fact that people might have underestimated how much it would cost, but the actual way that in which you manage a cash flow through a project becomes quite difficult if you have a very, very strict budget. And even people who might have a 20% buffer on top of those budgets, we're really, really struggling because of the demands of when you might have to pay, and finding that they were really scrabbling around. I think there's a case that I report on of a man who was maxing out his credit cards left, right and centre, and that money would come back to him because you get this VAT return at the end of the build, but you have to wait until it's finished before you can get it back.
I mean, and of course one has to think that if you're building your own house, the amount of stress and anxiety associated with it is enormous because it's so hugely consequential. Yeah. I mean, here's one of your subjects, a man called Steve, talking about the strain he was put under during the process.
Every challenge you take on in your job, what's the worst that can happen? The worst thing is that you get found out as being an idiot and you get sacked. That's not as bad as investing your own money and your own life savings and your family's future in a project, which is what we did here. And so the downside of getting it wrong was very serious. And it's not like being at work, because you don't have that risk.
And did you find that when they built the house, that the stresses that they'd gone through, that somehow these could be forgotten and they could sort of revel in their new house and put all that behind them?
So what was quite surprising was I went to visit Steve and his wife Elsa and their two girls about 6 months after they'd moved into the house. And I remember sitting down with Elsa and she turned around to me and I said to her, you know, you must be really, really pleased with what you've got. Because I was looking around thinking, you know, I've watched this go up from, you know, I came when it was first a skeleton. Now you're living here. And she's like, thanks for saying that. She's like, there's been no champagne popping moment. I can't see it. And that was repeated actually in the lives of quite a few of the other people. I would say that I suspect that over time that dulls a little bit. But the sheer quantity of decisions that you have to make on an everyday basis, the stresses related to finance, related to getting the timings right, I think do really take their toll.
And you talk about how important social relationships are. I mean, not just family relationship, but relationship with builders and others. Expand on that a little bit for me.
Yeah, I think that quite often, when we're looking at the individual households, they were very competent people in terms of the skills that they might have that would enable them to project manage. So they might be people who had managed teams of people previously, who'd worked in things like procurement. For example, Steve worked in procurement for the company that he worked for. And yet the thing that seems to catch quite a lot of people out is precisely how they manage those relationships with those people. And I think that those relationships are quite different to the relationships that they might have in a job, again, because of how much is at stake. Because a house is not worth anything until it's signed off, aside from anything else. Beyond, obviously, the very tangible emotional investments that people make in those properties. So it's very risky.
I just noticed, I mean, quite a few of the people, most of the self-builders you spoke to had some kind of related skills, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, so many of them were engineers. Is there anything, if you could sort of try to talk about some way in which people could be encouraged to build their own houses? I mean, what would you want to say? What might make it easier? What might propel more people to do it?
I think that there are lots of things that could make that easier. I think that actually perhaps it's more a question of thinking about putting in place a whole range of support systems that might help with that. Where we see self-build being taken up more extensively in places like Holland and Germany, actually they have industries that are much better tailored to supporting those, whereas here actually a lot of the people who are skilled, a lot of the products that you require are actually the products that are designed primarily with large-scale house builders in mind. And actually the experience is very, very different. So actually having a dedicated industry of providers would
thank
be good.
You for introducing me to such admirable people. Michaela Benson, thank you very much. Well, last week's discussion, remember, we were talking about charity and philanthropy. Well, it prompted some interesting and some aggrieved responses. Julie Bernstein regretted our neglect of people who gave up their time to charity. Yes, we didn't talk about that. While Katrina Schwendener found fault with the argument that because philanthropy makes people better off, there's no need to subject it to critical attention. That was sort of one of our guests was arguing along those lines. Thanks also to John Morris, who wrote from the Peabody Buildings, our weekly rent lorry goes to a charity, Mark Holder, and to Kerry Renshaw. Otherwise, well, I'm sorry to say, it was all about my old cake shop, Satterthwaite's, and Adrian Domford-Smith scientifically tested the proposition that their pork pies could be better than sex and concluded that the pleasures were incommensurable. While Stuart Edmondson explained his close family connections to the cake shop, and there was a long, touching account of the ups and downs of the business from the grandson of the founders. It's all very fascinating. Thank you all. And, oh, yes, yes, I have been instructed to say that other bakeries are available.
Mid pleasures and palaces, though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home.
You see, I don't really blame Vera Lynn. I mean, it's simply not easy to avoid sentiment when one starts to talk or sing about home. After all, home is where the heart is. It's where love begins. That's Mother Teresa, by the way. It's a shelter from storms. It's a haven in a heartless world. I think that was Christopher Lash. And this definitely is Jane Austen. There is nothing like staying at home for real comfort.
Sweet, sweet home, there's no there's no place like home.
But I must admit that I never properly appreciated the full, what you might call, human significance of home until I began to read an extraordinarily sensitive ethnography of those citizens of an American city who are denied that resting place, who are, in the chilling one-word title of the study, evicted. Well, the author of Evicted, which is subtitled Poverty and Profit in the American City, is Matthew Desmond, who's Associate Professor of the Social Sciences at Harvard University. I'm delighted he's in the UK at the moment. He's now with me in the studio. Matt, as I'm going to call you, but you told me. I wonder what led you, really, in the first place to study evictions. I don't think I can hardly remember any other study that I've ever come across. What led you to start on this?
America is unique compared to any other rich democracy for the depth and expanse of its poverty. And I wanted to understand that really from a ground level and understand the role housing plays in spreading inequality all across America. And I thought eviction was a really good way into that.
I mean, you were astonished, weren't you, when you began to look at it, about how many evictions were going on. You began to sort of look at the figures.
I had no idea. When I started, I thought eviction was a good way to understand the lives of low-income families struggling out there. I had no idea how prevalent it was and how consequential it was.
Give me some idea of some of the sort of figures that you were looking at, some of the figures you were finding when you began to look at the statistics.
If you dig into the eviction records in Milwaukee, you learn that every year in that city...
Yeah, we should say this is the city you studied, Milwaukee in Wisconsin.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. This book is based in Milwaukee, but it tells a broader American story. We've crunched the numbers in Cleveland and Chicago and New York, and we see similar things. So in Milwaukee, about 40 people every day are evicted. They're evicted in the summer and the winter. It's an incredible amount of people. In New York, they see about 60 Marshall evictions every single day in all five boroughs. So eviction has become, frankly, commonplace in low-income neighborhoods. We know from the national data that people in over 2.8 million renter households think that they're going to be evicted soon. That's a colossal number.
And, of course, you point out that in the past, evictions became... They led to protest. I mean, people would sort of like try and resist evictions, but now somehow it's almost taken for granted that there are going to be this number of evictions and there are no public protests about it.
When you read accounts in the 30s and the 40s of evictions, they were scandalous and rare. You know, people came out of their houses and protested and moved families back in. There was an account in the New York Times for three Bronx families being evicted in February that said, because of the cold, only 1,000 people showed up. But today we've gotten quite used to the rumble of the moving truck through the poor neighborhood and the early morning knock on the door and the fact that there are full-time sheriffs who are evicting people from sunup to sundown in some of our lowest lowest income communities.
I mean, you produce some really staggering figures. I mean, that one, I'm just picking up one of those, about 2.8 million Americans currently threatened with eviction. I mean, how do we understand this huge number?
The last decade, poor Americans have seen their incomes fall or flatline, but their housing costs have soared, not only their rents, but also their utility costs. So there's been a growing gap between what families have and what they have to pay for a roof over their head. And at the same time, where more and more families were needing assistance, fewer and fewer were receiving it from the government. I think most Americans still believe that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or benefits some way from government assistance, but the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 families that qualify for housing assistance receive it, which would be unthinkable with any other kind of basic need. What if we turn away 3 in 4 families that apply for food stamps? The waiting list for public housing in some of our biggest cities is not counted in years, it's counted in decades, which means a young parent who applied for public housing in Washington, D.C., for example, is probably a grandparent by the time her application comes up for review.
So there are some people who are getting no federal assistance whatsoever here.
Most poor families are getting no federal assistance.
Now, you look, as we were saying, we looked specifically at evictions in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, where, as you say, 40 people are being evicted every day. Just tell me a little bit about the area and its history and why you chose Milwaukee.
Milwaukee is about the 30th biggest city in America. It's a major American city. It's a Rust Belt city. So it was a city hit hard by deindustrialization, moving jobs overseas or to the Sun Belt in America. Between 1979 and 1983, Milwaukee lost more jobs than during the Great Depression. And the city's really never recovered from that. But it's still a city that I love and I felt called to. And I also thought that the story of the American city was really being written on the margins. We have a lot of books about New York or San Francisco, our biggest successes, some would say. And we have a lot of books about Detroit and cities that some people consider our biggest failures. But if you write about Milwaukee, you have a shot at representing a broader American experience.
I was interested because one would have thought, you know, the threats of eviction or something, there would be a possibility of, I mean, one hears about a lot of court cases which are concerned with evictions in this country. I read about them fairly regularly. But really, the processing through the courts is... it's hardly formal, is it? I mean, it just simply things go through on the nod. I mean, these people don't have much chance to protest in court about what's happening to them.
If you are arrested and you go to criminal court and you're found indigent, you're poor, the state will provide you an attorney because we've decided that you can't have a fair trial without an attorney by your side. But that's not the case in civil court. That's not the case in eviction court. And so most folks that are called to eviction courts have absolutely no legal representation. In some housing courts around the country, 90% of landlords have attorneys and 90% of tenants don't. So think if you're a tenant with maybe 11th grade education, 10th grade education, and you have to go up against your landlord's attorney, would we even show up? I don't think I would, and most tenants don't. So in Milwaukee, about 70% of families that are called to eviction court don't even show up.
And of course, if we want to understand exactly why there are so many people who fail to keep up the payment of their rent, then we've got to look really at the balance, haven't we, in terms of the percentage of a person's income, a family's income, which is going on the rent and which is going on other matters. And you've looked at that as well.
That's really the story. You know, in America for the last century, we have decided that we should spend no more than 30% of our income on housing. That gives us enough to buy food, transportation, put a little away for savings. And for a long time, most renters in the country met that goal, but times have changed to the point that today, the majority of poor renting families spend at least half of their income on housing, and 1 in 4 spend over 70% just to keep a roof over their head and heat in their house.
And I mean, not everybody, it's interesting, not everybody gets evicted when they fall behind in the rent. And you, in your study, you look at the people who are most likely to be targeted for eviction. Tell me about them.
So the face of America's eviction epidemic is moms with kids. And if you go into any urban housing court, you'll just see kids running around all over the place. In the South Bronx in New York City, until very recently, they had a daycare in their housing court because there were so many kids. And when I started this book, I thought, you know, kids would shield families from evictions, but it's the opposite. If you look at folks in eviction court and you want to know why you get evicted but I don't, the deciding factor is I have kids living with me. If you have children in your house, the chances of you getting an eviction judgment triple even after you control for how much you owe a landlord. And what you're seeing there is landlord discretion. You're seeing a landlord say, you know, kids use my curtains for superhero capes and flush toys down the toilet, and they can test positive for lead poison, and they can draw the attention from the police. Like a landlord told me when I was in Milwaukee, kids cause me headache.
I mean, I described this in the beginning as a very sensitive ethnography. I mean, we've been talking about some sort of hard figures and some brute statistics for a moment. But, I mean, you look, I mean, you tell, really, you look at eight families in the book telling their particular eviction stories. But a little one of them, I mean, tell me a little about this woman that you called in the study, you called Arlene, and describe her predicament, a little tiny bit about her story.
Sure. So evicted does start in the ground and end on the ground. It follows eight families through the process of eviction, including Arlene. And when I met Arlene, she was a single mom trying to raise two boys in a very poor neighborhood. And she was spending 80% of her income on housing and to live in a place that had holes in the windows and a ground-in carpet. And, you know, under those conditions, eviction is much more the result of inevitability than irresponsibility. And what happened to Arlene was she decided to pitch in some money for her funeral costs. She didn't have the money, but no one else did either, and she would have been ashamed of herself if she didn't. That started her on the process of an eviction, and then the book kind of follows her in the aftermath and shows, you know, what happens to her and her children after they're evicted in a very cold day in January.
I mean, you don't seem to, I mean, you don't paint all the people in your book as paragons of virtue. They're complex people. There's drug abuse, there's violence here, and one memorable passage, you describe how Arlie here is chooses to buy and cook an expensive lobster prior to eviction because she's marking the anniversary of her dead boyfriend. I mean, the harshest critic might say that poor tenants can at times be the agents of their own misfortune.
I think that there's two ways to dehumanize people. One is to cleanse them of all virtue, and the other is to scrub them of all sin. And, you know, I think that my job is to write about people's lives as fully, as completely as possible. When Lorraine did that, when she spent her entire allotment of food stamps on lobster, I was frustrated and confused, and I wanted to understand it. And I felt that my job was not to apologize for that, but to understand it. And I came around to understanding that, you know, Lorraine is not poor because she makes bad decisions, if that is a bad decision. She makes those decisions because she's poor. And there's no amount of scrimping or saving or good behavior that's going to lift her above the poverty line. She was a grandmother who was my neighbor in a trailer park, spending over 70% of her income on rent. And under those conditions, you know, you might as well live a little.
What your study brought home to me, which I hadn't properly appreciated before, was almost the difference a home makes. I mean, those, you know, if you have a home base, then it's possible that something positive can come out of it. I mean, you talk about one person who managed to get off the drug habit once he had a home.
Right.
Another person was able to study and sort of progress. But when you are in danger of being evicted, your work suffers.
Right.
You know, you become, you're constantly on the phone trying to find out somewhere else to live.
Right.
I mean, really, is the home is almost a guarantee, some sort of guarantee of stability, much more important than perhaps we've ever allowed it to be in the past in other studies.
The home is the center of life. We cannot fix poverty in America without fixing housing. And eviction, this thing that used to be rare, is coursing through our cities and acting like a cause, not just a condition of poverty. It pushes people into worse housing, into worse neighborhoods. It affects their children's schooling. It affects your mental health. If you add it all up, you realize that this thing is casting people on a different and much more difficult path.
Let me now bring in a comparative perspective, because I'm delighted to say that I've got someone here. There's Kirstine Payton, who's a lecturer in sociology and social policy at the University of Leeds, who's looked at the question of evictions in Britain. I mean, Britain and the United States, it'd be fair to say, isn't it, Kirstine, are very different histories in terms of housing and welfare policies. So one wouldn't expect to see identical eviction patterns here. But do you see any parallels? I mean, you've read the book. Do you see any parallels at all? I mean, is there an increase in evictions here in Britain?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is. It's different, but yeah, not different. And what Matt is reporting on in the US case is housing inequality following the financial crash, which had global ripple effects. So it's a trend that we can see in many countries. The UN Rapporteur for Housing, Raquel Rolnick, calls it a global paradigm shift in housing, where it's become financialised. It's not a social entity or social product provision as it once was. And we see the effects of that in the UK. In fact, I think it would be folly to suggest, or kind of naive to suggest, that we weren't going down the same road as America. In fact, we're more in step with America than we are other European countries in terms of evictions.
I mean, they are. I mean, I think they're at a 6-year high, aren't they? The 2015 figures. I mean, I don't know how. There's some sort of estimated, I've got a figure here, about 115 a day or something. Eviction.
Yeah, I mean, every time that the quarterly statistics are released, it's a new record high because it keeps increasing. So in 2015, it was 43,000 households in rented accommodation were forcibly removed. So that's a 53% increase since 2010. And I think that's the equivalent of around 170 evictions a day. But, you know, as Matt's book pointed out, that this is that doesn't capture informal evictions either. When people jump before they're pushed, for example, or when they choose to move. But also these figures from the Ministry of Justice are based on county court bailiffs and not from High Court enforced evictions as well. And landlords are increasingly using that pathway, High Court enforcement officers, to enact evictions because it's a faster process as well. So we don't have the full kind of extent.
But you presumably want to agree that the people here, tenants, have rather more protection against evictions than perhaps in the States. I mean, some of the ways in which these evictions get carried out, I mean, seem really like extra legal. They don't seem to hardly impinge upon the sort of the legality at all. But I mean, there is more protection here. When you read this book, you must have thought, well, people, tenants, aren't so badly off in the UK.
I mean, yes, I said for now, but we're still kind of currently kind of feeling the impacts of like many changes in welfare and housing. So, yeah, as I said, in terms of kind of like in comparison to Europe, in the UK, there is less protection. We've got shorter, less secure tenancies. We pay more on rent. More of our income on rent. Tenants in England are spending up to half their income on rent. So there are more dangers emerging in terms of evictions in the future as well.
Well, OK, I just want, very quickly, if you had to do one thing, I'm just asking you both, very, very quickly, one thing that you would do that might make the situation better, is there one, very quickly?
Is there one thing? I think you have to decommodify housing. I think you have to supply housing as a social provision for people.
Very quick.
We have to decide if housing is a fundamental right, if it's part of what it means to be an American. And I think we have to say yes, because without stable shelter, everything else falls apart.
Good. Thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you very much, Matthew. And thank you, of course, Kirstine Payton. Now, look, actually, Matthew, I do know that one person who would have very much relished your work would have been the geographer Doreen Massey, who died on March the 11th this year, because in the words of one obituarist, her analysis of the manner in which space is always socially constructed, an area of freedom for some, an area of fear for others, rescued geography from what Robert Robinson once called its limitless savannas of unleavened fact. Here, with the last words for today, is Professor Massey on Thinking Aloud back in 2008, talking about an urban paradox.
We're here in London, and that London is one of the cities par excellence in the world for the cultural mixing that is going on. We have to differentiate between who we're talking about, because the lonely refugee who arrives, or the person who's a migrant out of necessity, is going to feel very different about that anonymity from those of us who come for the buzz and for the excitement.
Doreen Massey, who will be missed by all. Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.